You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Cast today is with Marty Dubin, who is a clinical psychologist, serial entrepreneur, business coach, and advisor to C-suite executives and Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. He has founded several companies, including a multi-million dollar healthcare company, where he also served as CEO. As a former partner at talent firm RHR International, he has worked directly with hundreds of C-suite senior executives from Fortune 500 companies and Silicon Valley venture capital firms and their portfolio companies. And he has a new book. It's called Blind Spotting, How to See What's Holding You Back as a Leader. Enjoy the pod. Marty Dubin, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Thank you very much.
There's a story that we tell in our book, Yes and it's a story about a time when we put out an RFP for a new website. And one of the groups bidding on the contract had a rather brilliant owner and CEO. His work was fantastic. But after two meetings with him and his team, we actually took him out of the running based purely on his behavior at the meetings. Later, he asked us why they didn't get the contract, and we actually told him, which is not something that normally gets asked or told. And amazingly, he came back to us 6 months later. He had demoted himself. He got into therapy. He took some improv classes. And the company had been doing great without him at the helm. And that kind of happy ending is unfortunately not the norm in my experience. I assume maybe it's not the norm in yours either.
No, and it's those pivotal moments that, you know, leaders look back on, and whether, you know, it was not a desired outcome, maybe in a lot of ways, but it was the most important outcome. So that's a wonderful story.
Sometimes there's just these pithy lines that stick out in a book. And one of yours is, quote, things go well until they don't, end quote, which is, it may sound very simple, but that's kind of what happens. And then you're all sort of left wondering, well, why didn't it go well? And it seems to me that's the thing you're digging into this book in terms of people understanding the things that they don't see about themselves.
Yeah. And the natural inclination is not to look at themselves, right? When things go wrong, it's like, oh, it was the economy. Oh, it was the other guy. Oh, it was my team or whatever. And sometimes those are the right answers, but there's always probably an answer in there that has to do with the person. And that's what the book is about. And it is a bit of that catch 22 of, if they're a blind spot, how can you see your own blind spots? And we can talk a little bit about maybe clues to doing that. But the first clue is just being open to the fact that, you know, it's like the alcoholic saying, my name is Marty and I'm an alcoholic, whatever. So mm-hmm. It's to say, I need to look at myself and start to get some help doing that.
So you have this assessment tool that your publicist sent to me, who's become a friend. So I took it, and it was what I would consider to be eerily accurate, which is like, apparently I eat up a lot of oxygen in a room. I talk a lot. I maybe overwhelm other people with sharing their ideas. What was so hilarious about this was, I'm reading this assessment as I am just going in and out of these brainstorming sessions with our leadership team to bring new ideas to the table. And I was concerned that maybe I was adding too much and other people weren't adding. And I know there's no personality, you know, assessment that can be true to all things, because it can't cover all the different kinds of contexts. But it did strike me that this one, and we had people on the team who took the assessment as well, that all felt like, yeah, this feels like it's telling me something I should pay attention to.
Well, I love hearing that. You know, what we wanted to accomplish with the test is more a surgical look. I mean, a target at those two or three, four specific things about somebody. The test is not meant to be a full entire personality assessment or a global sense of who you are as a leader. It's really targeting in on where those places where you might be getting in your own way, you know, and, you know, my advice to you would be, you know, with that awareness, you and I would sit down or maybe the test, I'm not sure how much, the test does give some guidance, but it would have been like, all right, let's clock how much airspace you take up. Mm-hmm. What do you think would be the right amount in the meeting tomorrow? Maybe 20%. And then and you can do that. You're not changing your personality. No. All those brilliant ideas are still popping in your head. You're getting ready to say them, but you've got a little bit of a break on yourself to say, I'm not going to go over 20% today.
Oh, that's 100% what I did. I went and I'm like, I'm going to not be the first one to speak. And then when I do offer my ideas, I'm going to offer three and I'm going to wait. And yeah, I had another 15, but I could hold on to them and always provide them later. And I think the thing is, what this runs counter to are the cultural myths we've got about leaders as infallible, leaders needing to be so sure of themselves. And the other thing that we know from science, of course, is that there's a thing called the curse of knowledge, that sometimes the more expertise you have makes you even more blind.
Yeah, I mean, it's from a systems point of view, it's this kind of positive feedback loop. Positive feedback loop means you're doing great, keep doing more of it. You know, where a negative feedback loop is self-corrective. So the more success you have, the more you think it's due to yourself. Another point I make in the book a number of times, it's always the interaction of the person in the situation. And, you know, there are super talented people, and most leaders that I worked with were leaders at the top, and they were on target 90, 95% of the time. But that isn't enough always. And that getting that extra 5% or 2 or 3 percentage points can make all the difference. And it is small tweaks at those points to pay attention to what's getting in the way.
So Second City gets hired to go into all different kinds of businesses to help with teamwork and creativity and innovation and leadership and using improv skills to practice how to do those things better. And inevitably in these conversations, people in their various domains will be like, well, I know you've done this for like advertising people, but we're in tech and it's different. And I know maybe you've done this in a marketing context, but we're a leadership company. And I always find that really hilarious because what we're talking about is human behavior, which has absolutely nothing to do with your title necessarily, but even more importantly, nothing to do with whatever domain, because human beings kind of act as human beings do.
Yeah. And my version of that always happens is that people read a leadership book and think that, okay, now I've got the lessons, great lessons from that book, and that they can just apply them as if it's a playbook. And to your point, everybody has their own personality. You and I could read a book on what's the best way to lead a meeting, and we could take away the five rules out of that, and you're going to apply those five rules differently than I'm going to apply those five rules, because it's been, you know, I'm the tool of my personality is the tool of how those things get expressed. And so it's another version of your same point. You got to learn how your own personal operating model works. Like, well, how does your brain work? How does your personality work? Where are your strengths? Where do you overemphasize your strengths? Where do you get in the way? And, you know, it is some work, but it's, you know, I find it, most people find it curious. We all like to think about ourselves and understand ourselves better. And that's where it begins.
Let's define identity. It's chapter one is about that. How would you identify, how would you define identity?
Yeah, so I have six areas to look for blind spots. And the first one I talk about is identity. I thought it's a great way to kind of get into the book. And so identity are the name tags we wear on ourselves. I mean, whatever yours is, podcaster, leader, you know, innovator, those kinds of things. And it's the identities that we probably have 20 or 30, and there's probably a top five or six. And sometimes they're so deep, and they're so kind of we've worn those identities for so long, we don't even pay attention to how they kind of close off our world. I mean, when somebody becomes a parent, all of a sudden they start paying attention to diaper commercials, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that was not part of your identity before. And now that's where your focus is, something you didn't pay attention to before. So it narrows our focus. And the book begins with trying to find how your identities might be limiting your opportunities.
And I thought it was interesting that you say that your identity is the least fixed part of you, because I don't imagine that's something that people would think. I think they would think, well, my identity is very fixed, but it's not, huh?
Well, some identities are very fixed, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that, you know, parent, father, daughter, you know, whatever. But other identities, especially in the working world, we put them on. You know, somebody's trained as an engineer, their identity is an engineer. And to move up in the organizational hierarchy, you know, you get promoted to being a supervisor and a manager. And now no longer are you the super expert engineer anymore. You're running a team of other engineers. And if you don't shift your identity from being the engineer in your comfort zone of all that knowledge base and shift it to, I'm now a manager of other people, I need to get good at managing, that's my new identity, then you're going to be, you know, sitting there and redoing your people you delegate to their work.
About 10 years ago is when I stepped down from running Second City. I was basically the guy in charge here. And I started working with a group at University of Chicago, with a bunch of behavioral scientists on a program. And I remember my friend Heather Caruso said to me, she goes, you know, there's some research that shows for people who've had a lot of success in their career, that later in life, if they just keep doing the same thing, they tend not to be as happy. But if you can find an adjacent expertise, that is something that is going to serve you well, which is exactly what I was doing, was taking all the knowledge I gained at my time at Second City and then applying it in this other sphere of, rather than improv on stage, how about improv off stage and how people use it? And I feel like that's a change in identity, because I was no longer like the boss, but I was still in my sphere, just in a different way.
When I talked to leaders about this, and I saw this a lot in Silicon Valley, where super creative people and their identity is as an innovator, right? They're launching some new product to the world. And at some point when that catches traction and their business starts to build and they've got a market and so on, then they need to make a shift from innovator to business builder and eventually leader. And I don't know if you experienced this, but there should be some grief about that, right?
Sure.
I mean, you gave up that old identity that was, you know, brought you so much joy and everything else. And if you make the shift to a new identity because you see the attraction of doing that, the opportunities, there should also come with that a bit of a sense of loss.
All right. Chapter two is about motive. What could our blind spots be in when we're dealing with motive?
So we all have, this is the engine in the system, right? This is what pushes us as human beings toward goals. There's three universal motives. This was from a psychologist, McClellan at Harvard, in the workplace that I found to really hold true. Motives for power, achievement, and affiliation. And then we also have lots of individual motives based on our life histories and the way we were brought up. But I start with those three core motives. And probably from my point of view, the best is to have some balance there. When you become overly imbalanced in those motives, then though a single motive may be operating when it may not be the most appropriate. You know, we can always think about people commenting, oh, all he cares about is money, or all he cares about is the achievement. So that might come out as, you know, he's just in it to really get to the solution and he doesn't care what happens afterwards. Or I've seen the affiliation motive in leaders turn into fame, you know, just all the adulation. They want to be in the spotlight all the time. And they are not even that aware of how much that is driving their behavior, and trying to help point out where, I mean, you need to be able to shift those motives depending and blend them depending on what the situation is.
I thought it was interesting in this chapter where you talk about storytelling and motives. And it's an instant thing flashed on me, and it happened today. I had the note here, but this is what happened today. I was having coffee with the widow of the founder of Second City, Jane Solins, a lovely human being. So Bernie founded it 65 years ago. He's passed. And I hadn't talked to her in a bit, and she, you know, Second City has been through so much, and we had an ownership change and new leadership. And she's like, how are things going? And there's a story I tell about our CEO, Ed Wells. He's going to hate that I'm name checking him. Yeah. And he's only been with us a couple of years. But the story I tell is that we were on our first business trip together. We're in Orlando. We pull up to the location. The Uber driver can't get our credit cards to work, whatever the system. He's calling in. And he basically says, look, guys, just you can go. You don't have to pay. And Ed's like, no, that doesn't seem fair. We're downtown Orlando. I'm sure I can find a bank. And he gets out and he's checking his money. He finds a bank, comes back and pays him in cash. We get our bags out. We're there. The Uber drives away. And I turn to Ed and I go, you're the only CEO in America who would have done that.
Wow. Yeah. So the motive there is around fairness, as he kind of said. He was aware of that being his motive, right? He was kind of saying it. And here you are saying, come on, that may be a motive, but that doesn't work in the business world. What are you doing?
I love it.
And yet it did. But
it did.
The thing about stories, they are so powerful. I tell CEOs that, what are the stories being told about you? When I do a 360 and collect information about them, I hear these stories, and I've seen some CEOs who use that really well to establish culture. And it is, you know, you get past the being humble about it. I mean, the story is the story. And if it tells something about how you want the company to behave and how you want employees to behave, then that is a really important story, and figure out all sorts of ways. You guys are great at that. How to keep that story alive as a message of, here's what our company culture is about.
Yeah. And so what I'm doing is telling a story about someone else, which is also important. You want people telling stories about you. And then you've got your own stories. And I always talk about the fact that, I mean, I started at Second City in 1988 as a dishwasher. And the reason I do that, it's funny. It's true. But for me, it's also like, and I have deep domain knowledge of every aspect of this. I worked the box office. I worked the room. I did the dish. You know, I ran marketing. I did all of that stuff. So I know what I'm talking about when it comes to this thing. And that's what I'm trying to get across from you. But if I just tell you I have deep domain experience, no one cares. The fact that the film director, Jon Favreau, and I got hired as dishwashers in the same week, that's way more interesting and delivers the information I want delivered. We're not taught that.
Yeah. And, you know, you're reflecting on the fact that the book is story driven. You know, every chapter starts out with a story. I have, and we carry the stories through the chapters, and I bring in other little mini stories. You know, we're rich in terms of all the things that kind of make us up. And we're more than just a simple idea, like, you know, domain knowledge. So I think the reason stories stick so well with people is because, I mean, obviously that's what we've been doing as a culture forever, but it brings all that intricacy and subtleness and richness and everything else to an idea. And when we hear it, we're picking up all of that. We're not just picking up those domain knowledge, two words. We're picking up all that other stuff around it. And so it sticks.
All right. So let's talk about traits. This is chapter 3. So traits are actually different from skills or states.
Right. Yeah. So traits are, and as you mentioned, you know, you can change your identity. It does change over time. Traits, I think, are pretty much built in. Skills are things you can develop. You can get better at golf or improv, but there's a certain improv skills that traits that are probably built in that make certain people better at improv than others. And so recognizing what those traits are, and most leadership books and a lot of leadership research focuses on traits. It's of all the six areas I've got, this is the one where there's the richness in the literature. But the aha experience I had when I was doing 360s with leaders used to be two buckets. And when I, you know, I'd hear all the positive things the person's great at, and then all the areas where they could have improvement. And I'd look at those two separate lists. And then after a while, I started to see the connection that the weaknesses were really the flip side of the strengths. And often they were the overplayed strengths. So this is probably the easiest blind spot, quite frankly, for people to recognize. You know, if you are organized and you think that's a super trait, if you are decisive and that's a super trait that people point to as a leader, then I often say, well, let's just add the modifier two to that, T-O-O. What happens when you are too organized, when you are too decisive? You know, tell me about the stories that people tell about you or the frustrations they have with you when you are two of your strengths. And so the question here is do you know when that tipping point is? Are you aware of picking up cues of when you've tipped over and you're overusing that strength and that becomes a problem?
All right, I want to try something out on you, this idea. So we were talking to Laura Huang on the podcast, who's got a terrific new book. And I kind of, during our conversation, this popped into my head because you talk about the big five, right? The big five personality traits: extroversion, openness to experience, accommodation, conscientiousness, neuroticism. One of the things I've realized about very good improvisers, people who are well-trained in improvisation, is, of course, and everyone gets this, they're very open to new experiences, right? That makes perfect sense. But the other thing that they're very good at is quick decision making because they have no script. So right. Yes, but if you don't have the decision making, just being open does not make you interesting on stage. Which makes you interesting on stage is the things you say in connection to for you being open to experience. I don't think as a culture we tie those two things together. We don't think that there is a person who does those things.
Yeah, and this is the complexity, quite frankly, of doing leadership coaching is kind of looking at the whole person and picking up on two or three or four different kind of traits. I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
So there was a leader I worked with, entrepreneurial leader, very confident, obviously same kind of thing. You need to be super confident if you're mm-hmm. an entrepreneur because you're breaking new ground and you're doing things people say you can't do it. It's never been done before. And he also was very curious, open to new experiences. And so he would ask lots of questions and everything else. So we got two traits there. Third trait is he also was very decisive. Again, all positive traits. But what would happen is here's this confident guy talking to his team, asking lots of questions, knowing he needs to make a decision on a direction. And really where he's at is he's going to make the decision. And so at some point he has now gotten all the information. He's made the decision. And then his team starts to experience him no longer as confident and open, but as arrogant. He's done. He's dismissive. We're done now. Thank you very much. You know, we're ready to move on. And it was starting to have real problems on the team. People had started to leave and become dissatisfied. And again, back to these kind of small tweaks, I couldn't tell him, you know, don't be arrogant. He certainly didn't see himself that way. But I could say, you know, when you stop being curious, when you are decisive, that's when your team, you're at risk of pissing off your team and making them feel like you don't care about them and they're feeling dismissive. So how about we substitute in, thank you very much, I've got the answer to, you know, I really think I'm getting close to an answer here, but I need to think about it some more. How about we talk about it again next Tuesday? I'll sit on it. You can, you know, and he's obviously found that there were some times when he didn't fully have all the information and the answer. And other times when even if he did, by the time he talked to that person and engaged with them again, they felt included. They didn't feel like he was being dismissive.
So I wonder, you know, you've been a psychologist, you've been a coach, essentially, right?
Right.
In those regards. And there's a thing in improv. So while Second City has directors, our field of improvisation, primarily there are coaches. And there's a thing called side coaching, which comes out of Viola Spolin, who's the godmother of improvisation. Side coaching is when you're giving sort of gentle guidance from the side during an improv scene. You're not telling the person what to do, but you're saying things like, listen deeply right now, or take your time. You know, that sort of thing, because you're trying to lead them. And what we found over time is like, just giving, like, we know this in theater. You can't, don't give someone a line, what we call line reading. Don't tell them to say it like this because they're going to be resentful and they're not going to do it. Is that the same thing that's true when you're talking to business executives, that you have to guide them a little bit and cajole them a little bit with understanding how you might motivate them to change a bit of the way they do things?
Yeah. Really what I hope happens with this book is that with these six areas that that's the blueprint. Yeah. I come from being a psychotherapist, as a clinical psychologist. I had a diagnostic manual trying to figure out where's the problem and then tools and techniques. So I, you know, just using your example, you know, maybe there's five or six dimensions. One of the dimensions is about listening that you're talking mm-hmm. about in that one example. And, you know, I would say that maybe you'd have told that person ahead of time, you know, listening is not your greatest strength sometimes, I've noticed. And so guess what? From the sidelines, I might, you know, give you the finger, touch your ear, exactly, something that says, listen more, and that'll be the cue. And I liken it to the golf coach changing your grip on your, you know, on your club a quarter of an inch, and all of a sudden you got 20 more yards on your drive. And it's these small little tweaks, but they're tweaks at the real core issues that are getting in the person's way.
One of my favorite lines in the book, and this is chapter 4, which is about emotion. You say, quote, executives who don't take emotion into consideration are leaving out an entire data set, end quote. I have never understood the hey, it's business. It's not emotional. It's like, right. Have you met a human?
Yeah. I mean, I found that was the opening I could use with a lot of these technology engineers who would have great arguments about, you know, in their slide deck or what a presentation and everything else, and then be frustrated. Why didn't everybody agree with me? I gave this perfectly rational argument about why this was the way things go. And I said, well, you know, we could talk about why this person and that person didn't go along with it. And it had to do with the emotional realm. And by approaching these engineers with, you know what, that's just a data set. It's, you don't have to get crazy about it. You don't have to think it's, you know, magical or unreasonable. It's just data. What, you know, how smart are you if you're not paying attention to a huge data set?
Tomorrow I'm interviewing Caroline Fleck, who's written a book called Validation. So it's basically sort of saying in a variety of different therapies, this idea of validation comes across all the time, where simply non-judgmentally you're validating the emotional response of someone across to you, because an emotion doesn't lie. And you don't have to, you have to agree with this person, you have to do that, but you validate them, and that gives you, you know, the first step towards evolving a relationship, or, you know.
Right.
And it's been so interesting having read your book and then read this book, and I'm in these various situations with people where I decide to put the phone down, fully look at them, repeat what they say to me, and say like, oh, that sounds like that sucks what you're going through for these reasons. The shift in terms of how that person is relating to me has been profound. And yeah. And that is, I mean, there's emotional self-regulation. There's other things that are going inside in that, but that's a big part. I mean, even the next chapter, which is about intellect, I think that, and I think you would think so too, that kind of EQ factors into intellect.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and it does start with being aware of our own emotions first. And being able to recognize our emotions, you know, and thinking about emotions almost like colors. Can you just be aware of all these different gradations? Things aren't just mad, sad, or glad. You know, there's all these variations, and the more aware you are inside, and then more aware the ability you have to kind of regulate your own emotions can then allow you to be open to other people's and identify them.
Can you talk a bit about the different kinds of intelligences that you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is, I'll call this my experimental chapter because it's, you know, I don't have anything to back this up other than just kind of personal experience, but we fetishize, and psychologists are the most guilty of this, IQ, and just that, what I call in the book, horsepower, that analytical power. I can't tell you how many times somebody would say, oh, you're going to meet so-and-so. You know, they are just wicked, wicked smart, which I always think is such an unusual, you know, but I'm not sure what that really means. But but the point is they're so smart. And that, you know, rules the day so far. But I've seen leaders who are just super effective, you know, who are probably got B's in school, you know, or even C's at school. And just, and so that high IQ is more fitting with academic and more correlated to academic achievement. So I talk about, that is horsepower. I talk about speed of processing, which has got to be huge for you all in what you do. I mean, just on the moment, be able to think quickly and then come out with something articulate and be able to do it. There are plenty of people who are smart, but need to sit back and I'll get back to you tomorrow. They need to process. So that's a really important intellectual skill. Another one is the creativity and just these out of the box. There's not even a box. Let's just think about things, make unseen kind of connections. And often leaders tend to dismiss that. It's like, don't be disruptive in the meeting. That has nothing to do with what we're talking about. When oftentimes there's some gem in there that just really opens people's minds up. And then the final one is probably this, I call it street savvy, kind of head on a pivot. You're paying attention to all sorts of data all around you all the time. And these people just come up with really well thought out ways to bring kind of the interpersonal people part together with intellectual problem solving. And that street savvy really is hugely important in business and leadership.
And what's great about the sixth, which is behavior, is that if your behaviors don't match all those other things in the previous chapters, you're kind of toast.
Yeah. Well, all these things show up in your behavior, right? That's
what
we see. They see and we see that in others and in ourselves. And I focus on, just from my own years of working with leaders, three what I call complex behaviors, that all leaders are good at to some extent, but the super leaders I've seen are the ones that are super, really sophisticated at communication, influence, and prioritization, and really, have those figured out. And the prioritization is just an interesting one. I read a really influential article in Harvard Business Review Journal 20 years ago by the head of Procter & Gamble, E.G. Laffley, where he had the intriguing title, What Can Only the CEO Do? and that only word, rather than do what you think you're best at or do what you like to do or do what the previous CEO did, what can only you do in that role? Some people only want to talk to the CEO. Only the CEO can make certain kinds of decisions. So I talk about five areas that I think that only the CEO, and you can replace that with other leadership titles. And so that helps prioritize. If you're not doing those five, then, you know, no matter what you're doing, you're really missing the boat in your role.
All right. I want to go through those because I sent those to my CEO. I was reading that part of the book. I sent it to him and he goes, this is really good. it is five things only a CEO could do. CEO could do. Select the senior team. Have the final say on corporate priorities. Make the strategic decisions about what resources to deploy in the short and long term. Own the culture. Great. Own certain external relationships, the board, key customers, key public officials, key stakeholders, and investors. That is kind of it. Any other person in the organization can do the other stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, there's other things a CEO will do, right?
Sure.
You know, get projects and other kinds of things, but they still need to have those five kind of always up front in their mind and do a gut check maybe every Friday. How am I doing? Did I do these? And you mentioned about you made a comment about the culture one, and that one is so, so important.
Yeah.
You know, leaders live in a fishbowl. Everybody's watching every behavior they do and all those behaviors, all those things, how you dress, whether you showed up with a smile today or not, all those things, you know, are affecting the culture of the company. And you don't have to do everything about the culture. You've got other leaders who could be very helpful in HR and communications. But you need to own it. You need to be the person that really thinks about, you gave that earlier example, you know, with your CEO where that kind of moral, you know, decision making was so crucial. And so knowing that you own that and really making sure that that is carried throughout the company is just a super important one.
Yeah, I find that it's a signal of integrity in terms of what Ed did, and I think how he leads. That is a thing that gets people on board in a way that a lot of other behavior. You can't. I think the days of the top down leadership, like I do it because I said to do it, those are gone. We're seeing that. I was in this conversation actually earlier today with a bunch of leaders. There's a group that I meet with regularly that are leadership experts who were in military and sports primarily. And it's always so fascinating to me that a place like the military has already read the research and made the adjustments and the changes to do their training in ways that everyone else is catching up to when we all would think about the military as being very, very top down, right? And structured. And of course it is to a certain extent, but that's not where the enemy lives and they know that. And so they shifted to much more dynamic, both and thinking, yes and thinking, all that sort of thing. And corporations are following suit because they know they need to stay ahead. Now we just need the politicians and everyone else to figure it out.
Well, yeah, I talk about nine types of influence in the book. And one of them is that do it because I say so. And, you know, you want the fire chief when the call comes in to say right? And not let's sit around the table and decide who wants to go and what our mission is and everything else, right?
Absolutely.
So there's a place for that top down, but knowing just how limiting it is and how you kind of use it at, you know, your risk, right? Because you're pushing people when they may not want to be pushed. So you don't want to overdo that one, but being aware that you've got, you know, I identify nine different tools to have in your back pocket and be thinking about what's the influence tool that fits for this situation, these type of people or this individual or this venue, and being able to be sophisticated and real facile of being able to shift.
We always end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yes. And my career story in the book is a pretty good example that I was a psychotherapist and that was my identity. And I thought that's what I'm going to do my whole life and had an opportunity to kind of look at a business opportunity in mental health care. And I, looking back on it, I did exactly the yes. And I still kept my private practice, but I kind of cut back a few hours on it and started to experiment in this other area of managing behavioral health and thinking about it kind of as a population based rather than an individual in my office. And, you know, clearly it led to where I am today in many ways. And I don't know how you feel about this, but probably about 10 years ago, I have a mantra of two things that I really live by now. And one is that serendipity happens, mm-hmm. pay attention. Mm-hmm. And the traditional one of opportunity knocks, open the door. And just by paying attention and opening the door, doesn't mean you have to go through the door, or maybe go through more than just a couple inches. But just that awareness that all life presents all sorts of opportunities and serendipity for us, and just being curious about it and taking that next step is, quite frankly, I do live by that.
Yeah. Dan Pink and I talked about this with regard to his last book, which is about regret. And we rarely regret the things we do, more often regret the things we don't do. So go to the meeting, go to the wedding, go to the, take a chance on someone said, hey, I think you should have coffee with this person. Have coffee with them. The best stories I have from my life were the random encounters that I had that then became, this person became my friend for life because I, had a coffee.
Whoever's telling you to have coffee is probably picking up on something.
Yeah.
Right? That's right. The serendipity of it. There's some, chemical attraction. There's something going on. So all right, believe that and just take a step.
I love it. The book is called Blind Spotting, How to See What's Holding You Back as a Leader. Marty Duin, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly. It's been super enjoyable.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.